Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Generations Speak. On November 11th, veterans from multiple generations and wars gathered at the Bell Trace Senior Living Community to talk about war and how it has changed over time. Panelists ranged from age 35 to age 95. Veterans Gene Shipp, Bill Porteous, Bob Price, Chris Snell, and Susan Savastik sat on the panel. The moderators for this event were Mary Elfman, who is a Veteran Services Officer for Monroe County, and John Summerlot, who is the Director of Veteran Support Services at Indiana University.
The audio for today's episode is courtesy of Community Access Television Services.
We begin tonight's episode with an introduction of the event.
This is the second Generation Speaks that we have hosted, and the whole idea of Generation Speaks is to have a dialogue between and across generations. And we have changed a topic every year. Last year, you might remember, we talked about being mortal, and it was a very interesting conversation. So back again this year is Generation Speaks, and tonight's topic will be military service and how it's changed over the course of time. A huge topic, I realize, but we'll try to do the best we can and to get you out by 9 o'clock. I want to tell you that this event is a special event that has been coordinated by service learning students at Indiana University who are enrolled in the School of Public Health, and they are taking a special events program development class, and they've worked very hard in bringing this to you. So with that, I will turn it over to one of our first, Amanda, and she's going to introduce our moderators and our veterans.
All right, I would first like to introduce tonight's moderators, Mary Elfman. She's the Veterans Services Officer of Monroe County, Indiana. And John Summerlot. He is the Director of Veterans Support Services at Indiana University. And I would also like to introduce tonight's veterans panelists and read their bios. Our first veteran, Gene Shipp, right here. He served in the U.S. Army from 1942 to 1971, retiring with the rank of Master Sergeant. He served in three major wars and was awarded the Bronze Star in 1969 by President Nixon. Next is Bill Porteous. Bill served in the U.S. Army from 1953 to 1977. After retiring as a lieutenant colonel in the infantry, Bill worked as a veterans representative in Bedford, Indiana. Next is Bob Price. Bob served in the U.S. Marine Corps from 1960 to 1964. Although he served at a time of peace, he lived in Camp Pendleton and in Okinawa, ready to be in service 24 hours a day. Next is Chris Snell. Chris joined the U.S. Marine Corps from 2003 to 2011, and he was deployed to Iraq twice, as well as Afghanistan and Africa. He was awarded a Bronze Star with combat, along with many other achievements. Our last veteran is Susan Savastik. She served in the U.S. Air Force from 1977 as a medical service specialist. Susan was awarded Airman of the Month and nominated for Airman of the Quarter. In 1979, she was honorably discharged and has since retired after a 35-year nursing career.
Good evening, everyone. Wonderful to have you all here. I can't tell you how much I appreciate being asked to participate in this event this evening. I want to thank all the veterans who are sitting on my panel. I know I've talked at least two of you into this that didn't necessarily know you were going to do this. And for all the veterans who are in the audience, thank you so much for your service. Thank you so much for everything you've done for this country. So without further ado, John, you want to take the first question?
Sure.
Great.
So if we would, we'll start off with our first question, which is, when did you know that you wanted to join the military? So, any volunteers to go first?
I didn't know because I was drafted.
Gene, tell us how, when did you find out you were going to be drafted? How much notice did you get going into that?
Well, I went rabbit and squirrel hunting, and I came back from...
Hold your microphone.
I came back from my hunting. I went hunting the rabbits and squirrels, and I came back from hunting. My mom says, "You have a greeting today." I said, "Who from?" She said, "The president." I knew I'd been drafted right then.
I guess I decided to go in the Army about midway through college. Went to a land-grant school, and they required military training the first 2 years, and volunteered for the next two. Had some very good instructors from the Army and that were inspirational.
All right. Bob?
I was had the choice of either going into the Army or the Navy or that, and I chose the Marine Corps, and I volunteered just ahead of the draft.
Well, I was my uncle inspired me. He was a Navy CB for 20 years, and I was going to originally go into the Navy. And then 9/11 occurred, and that's when I realized that we're in something a little more serious than me doing a construction job at this point. So I actually volunteered and went over to the Marine Corps and signed up with them.
And I was highly motivated by the power of suggestion from my mother. I was an average student in high school, and I really didn't think I had the potential to be a good student in college. Didn't have enough faith in myself that I could make it through. So my mother said, "Well, if I were you, I'd join the Navy." And so I thought about that for a while, and I tried to join the Navy, but they wouldn't let women on ships back in 1977. So I switched and went to the Air Force instead. So that's how I decided.
So what were your jobs as you were serving in the military? What was it that, were you combat? Were you field artillery?
I was a battalion motor sergeant.
Huh?
Most of my, then I was also an instructor at automotive schools in Germany and Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Yeah, Bill?
I had many jobs in the Army, platoon leader, company commander, battalion commander, staff officer. I was in Vietnam twice, first time with an irregular force and the second time with a 199th Separate Light Infantry Brigade.
May I have a follow-on question there, Bill? What's an irregular force?
Well, it was called a battalion, but it had 17 rifle companies in it and a bunch of irregulars. They were not part of the Arvin Army, and but they were very active. And the force was about 4,000 people. They called it a battalion. We would call a battalion about 800 people.
What about you, Bob?
I was in the Marine Corps artillery as FDC, where you basically gave the guns the information for them to fire, and you took that information that was fed to you from the forward observer. And we also did field survey, and this was at the battalion level.
Chris?
I was in the infantry, and I was a mortarman, so I knew exactly where you were going with the FDC piece. I was the guy taking the orders from you. But I did that for about 3.5 years, and then I reenlisted into a unit called Foreign Military Training Unit. Had a 2-sentence mission statement, and there was nothing else on it, saying that I was going to go over and train host nation forces. And I said, well, that sounds about way better than these 2 Iraq deployments that I just made. So went over there and started training, and then in the middle of my training, found out that I was actually training to become a special operations operator. And then it transitioned into Foreign Military Training Unit, and then Marine Special Operations Advisor Group, and then now it's known as 3rd Raider Battalion. So a lot of my jobs were out there, but I did a weapons sergeant job as a special operator, and it basically dealt with knowing every single weapons piece that we used along with foreign weapons and conducting a lot of ranges where we shot a lot of ammunition and grew blisters on our hands.
I had another disappointment as I was trying to get into the Air Force. I wanted to be a photographer. You know, they give you this sheet that you can look at and decide what your career path will be. So when I finally was getting in, they said, well, we have enough photographers. We're going to have to make you do something else. So I took an aptitude test, and it showed
as far as they told me, that I would be a really good person in healthcare. And so I ended up being a medic, a medical service specialist. And I worked during peacetime, so I was in the largest military hospital at the time, I think, in Lackland Air Force Base. And I worked on a nursing unit. I was probably a glorified nurse's aide, but I did so many more things than what a nurse's aide or orderly would do today. So that's was my career path, and it led me to a great nursing career after I got out as well.
Some of you have already touched on this, but what was your family and your parents' reaction? What were their feelings about your service, and how did they feel about both, you know, you're joining the military in general, but also going off to somewhere else far away, be that war or otherwise?
War ended, World War II ended. I came back from Europe, and they made some good offers to me. If I re-enlist, they give me another stripe and a lot of other goodies, and I accepted it. And when I decided I was going to stay in the military, I was sent to Japan for occupation duty in Yokohama, Tokyo area. And when I was there, I requested to go to automotive school and get my training to a job that I wanted, always wanted to do. And so that's what I got my certificate as mechanic, automotive, first class mechanic, and I've stayed in that field my whole career in the military.
You ask about the family?
Yeah.
I'm the first one in my family to have been in the service, going back to, I think, an uncle of a grandmother was in the Philippine insurrection or something, but that was a long time ago. So they were very favorable, questioning at first, what are you going to do? But they accepted it.
When I went into the Marine Corps boot camp, during my second month, I broke my leg. So that meant I spent an extra... I spent an extra 3 months in boot camp. And by the time I got home, my family had moved to Florida. That's it.
Well, my parents didn't certainly move to Florida. My mother was a little worried, knowing that I was getting into something that we just initiated in 2003, was our initial push to Baghdad, and I was joining and going to boot camp in July of 2003. So she was a little worried, knowing there's some consequences that are going to be there for me later. My dad was all for it. He was an Air Force veteran, but he certainly had a very stoic look and honorable peace that I think he felt a little honored that I was joining the military to do something to give back to the country.
If I may tap on to Bob's response, before I got into the Air Force, my enlistment was delayed as well because I broke my foot playing tennis, and so I had to put that on hold. So that started this whole anxiety thing that you're not going to get in, that they're not going to take you once, you know, the foot heals. And I think my mother didn't think I'd take her suggestion seriously. So they were kind of surprised because I was the only family member who had at that time taken a career path into the military. So they were scared, but it was peacetime, so I think that made them feel a little bit better. I have four brothers who were still going through high school, and I don't think it made much difference to them because I was getting out of their hair as their bossy sister. So I think everybody dealt with it fairly well.
Well, Bob, besides both of us going to the same boot camp, we also share that, you know, my parents, while I was overseas in the Marine Corps, also moved to Florida without telling me, and I found out when I got back. So I understand that one.
My mother, when I returned from boot camp and my AIT, and I stepped off the aircraft, and my mother looked at me and she says, "Well, you now, finally, you stand up straight." So for that reason, she was quite pleased that I had joined the military. I'd like you to, if you don't mind, just share with us where you served, all the places you've served. Yeah, especially you, Jane, because I think it's important that we know where you've been.
Well, my basic training was in Georgia, at Fort Benning. From there, I was shipped to advanced training and combat training in Fort Clark, Texas. And from there, I was shipped overseas to North Africa. We invaded Casablanca and went down the coast of North Africa. And on from there, we invaded the island of Sicily, captured that one. Then we went into Anzio Beachhead. Then on up the boot of Italy to the war ended back in 45 when I came home. I served in Korea, invaded Incheon, and I was over there for 18 months. I came back. I had occupation duty, two tours of occupation duty in Germany with my family, my son, my daughter, and my wife. We stayed in Germany. We lived in Germany for 7.5 years. And then I went to Vietnam, stayed a year there. And that's I returned back from Vietnam and was stationed at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And that's where I retired with 30 years of service.
I started out at Fort Benning, same place, Camp Atterbury, Indiana, Fort Carson, Colorado, Heilbronn, Germany, Baumholder, Germany, back to Fort Benning, then back to ROTC duty at my own alma mater, Ohio University, then to Vietnam the first time, then to Fort Ord, California. From there, went to Leavenworth, and then to Panama, then back to Vietnam, then to the Pentagon, then to Indiana.
Welcome home.
Mine is a lot shorter.
That's all right.
I went to San Diego for boot camp, went out of there to Camp Pendleton. From Camp Pendleton, I went to Okinawa, stayed in Okinawa about 18 months, and during that time, we went to Japan itself for a month, and then come back to Camp Pendleton, and that's where I met my wife, at the beach at Camp Pendleton, and finished there.
Well, I'm also a Hollywood Marine. That's what they call the California Marines.
That explains so very much.
Hey!
I know.
Hey.
They're the best ones you've ever met. All humbleness aside. So I went to San Diego, graduated from boot camp there, and then went to School of Infantry at Camp Pendleton. And then once I graduated from there, they said, 29 Palms, California. And for those of you who are not geographically inclined, that is the desert of California. And I pretty much lived in the desert for 3.5 years because I lived in 29 Palms, California. I trained there because it's a live fire base, which is best training was done in 29 Palms just because you got to use live ammunition. You weren't using simulation round or paintball guns. And then I was deployed to Iraq for 7 months in February to September of 2004. Came back to 29 Palms, took a little bit of leave, went to Indiana, and then I got out of that desert for a minute. Came back, went back to 29 Palms, trained up, deployed back to Iraq in September of 2005 to March of 2006. Re-enlisted, went to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, did my training there, and deployed to Afghanistan in 2008 from May to December, and then made it back to North Carolina again. Went to Fort Benning for jump school. Came back to North Carolina. Fort Benning was in Georgia. Came back to North Carolina. Then I left for Africa for 6 weeks. And then I went back and forth to California for training. And then I stayed in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina until I got out in 2011. Oh, so I did a 6 week mission where I trained the Senegalese Special Forces on some reconnaissance and close quarters combat training. So it was a joint training operation. There was nothing too secretive there.
So I'll tell you another story. I started out in Youngstown, Ohio, where I was living at the time with my family. And it was time to go to Cleveland, Ohio for that physical that you take before you really pass your enlistment process. Well, when I got to Cleveland, I was a half a pound over the weight maximum for my personage. And so they said, well, if you go back home and lose a half a pound and come back tomorrow, you can retake the physical. Well, it's January, and it's snowing and icy, and Youngstown's about a 2.5-hour drive to Cleveland. And I came home I should have known that, you know, there's so many things that were stopping me from going in the military. I should have known to just not continue, but I did. And my father brought me back home, and I was crying, and we had, and some woman up in Cleveland at the place where we were getting the physicals, she gave me, which I'm sure was some type of amphetamine diet pill. And so I came back home. I ran in the snow like all night trying to lose this half a pound, went back up, and indeed got in. But the only place I was San Antonio, Texas. I did some training up in Oklahoma, but that's where I spent my 21 months, and I think there's another question about how we got out of the military later. So that's where I was.
You've been listening to Generation Speak on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Just finished listening to the panelists at the second annual Generation Speak event talk about their experiences as a veteran and during their time in the military. Panelists range from age 35 to 95 and included veterans Gene Shipp, Bill Porteous, Bob Price, Chris Snell, and Susan Sebastik. Mary Elfman and John Sommerlott moderated the panel. We now return to the panel discussion.
So if you would, now that we have some idea of what your experiences are and kind of where you're coming from, tell us one of your more memorable stories that comes from your experience, most likely one involving camaraderie or something to do with other folks that you were stationed with or trained with.
I think the most memorable time for me was in basic training because I was raised in a very suburban white community. I did not know a person of color or of any other race or ethnicity, and got thrown into San Antonio, Texas with a whole gamut of women who from New York City and the Bronx, and it was just amazing the rainbow of people that I was around that I had never experienced before. So that I think was probably, because I didn't spend much time in the military, so I think that 6 weeks in basic training really opened my eyes to what the world really was like instead of what I was raised at home.
I would say my most memorable moment was when we were on base in Iraq. The electricity went out on our base because it was raining and it kind of flooded the area. And it snowed as well, just so you know. It does snow in Iraq. So it flooded the area, and then our electricity went out. So we got bored. And when Marines get bored, you're on for a show. If you haven't seen any YouTube videos, we're there. We pretty much own it. One of our guys, we had an NCO section of the housing kind of split off by 2x4. And plywood. Like, we really separated ourselves. But somebody threw a Kim light over, and then we threw it back, and they threw it back over.
What's a Kim light?
Oh, a Kim light. So you snap it, and it glows in the dark. I don't know if anyone's ever seen
civilians
that.
Call them glow sticks.
Glow sticks. Oh, glow sticks. Okay, gotcha. Sorry. But we kept throwing the Kim light back and forth. And then we decided that we're going to put our helmets on, and we're going to put our goggles on, and we're going to go all out. So we opened up like 16 boxes of glow sticks, and we decided to have a chem light war. And we did, and they captured one of the NCOs, tied him up. They hog-tied him, and we went in for a rescue mission. And then our platoon sergeant came in and said, like a father would, "What's going on in here?" So we're having a chem light war. He said, "Good, clean this crap up and go fill some sandbags." Roger that, Gunny. But that was one of my most memorable moments.
One of mine was being in 29 Palms doing live fire missions with the Marine Corps. And we also had the honor of training reservists. Well, they talked to their officers by first name. And for a regular Marine, that's kind of unnerving. But I was up on the forward observer post, and we could look down at the battery sitting there. And you get to know after a while where the guns are and where the ammo pit is. Well, we're sitting up there, bored, looking around, and this one guy comes walking into the ammo pit. And then all of a sudden, everybody in the ammo pit split to the wind, and they were running hard enough that they were kicking up dust as they ran. And I mean, this is scattered to the winds. And we later found that he had gone to the ammo pit and lit a cigarette. And nobody said anything to him. They just left. That's it for me.
Let's see. One memorable moment would have been Christmas Eve of 62. I was in Vietnam, and the supposedly was a slight ceasefire for the holiday. And so people were pretty relaxed, carrying just sidearms and pretty much gone into the base. Weren't out on any kind of patrols or anything. And this rhythm started. And you could hear it, real deep rhythm. It wasn't a drum, it was something else. And people got a little bit suspicious, and everybody went, got their basic weapons. And coming down a stream, which led in from the Mekong River, was this beautiful sailboat. And they were tapping out some kind of rhythm, and they were rowing this sailboat because there was no wind that was coming through a narrow channel of water. And they had lights all over this sailboat. It was just absolutely beautiful. I'm running out of time. Thank you.
I can remember in Germany, I had my wife and my son, daughter, with me for 3.5 years. And duty was beautiful over there, and some of the best I've had since I was in the service. And when I finished my 3 years, and I was waiting for my orders to return back to the United States for duty back in America. When I received my orders, my orders read, direct assignment from Germany to Vietnam was the first cab. Oh, that was awful. And when I landed in Vietnam, the plane landed, it was rounds coming in when the plane landed. It had bunkers built on the side of the runway, so when you get off the plane, you find your hole and get in and stay there till things clear down. But that was some of the worst duty I ever had, was in Vietnam. I had my first time to see a Vietnamese soldier dressed in uniform. Everybody was dressed like you are. And they were soldiers, you didn't know it. So I had to put up with that for 12 months. But I came back home safely, and thank God I'm still here.
So when you came, when you got out of the military, some of you have mentioned folks that you met along the way and whatnot else. Did you have any people that you remained friends with? Were there connections and people that you still knew? I mean, for the most part, I mean, with one exception, you were all pre-Facebook. You know, there wasn't an option to track people through social media. Did you stay in touch with folks that you served with, and do you still to this day, or anybody in particular?
Well, most of them that I, my age, which is 97, they all gone to glory. They're not here no more. But I retired at Fort Knox, and I made my home here in Bloomington. And when in the military, you're accustomed to leaving and making friends. You stay at a place 3 years, you're gone, you got to meet new friends. Y'all broke into that type of environment. You can make friends and meet people and go off and the same thing, meet people. That's your lifestyle.
Yes, fellow that was in the same company with me in Germany, talked to just the other day. He lives in California. We keep in touch. We're both car nuts. And he goes to much more elaborate car shows in California. And there's a military retired group here in Bloomington that we meet occasionally.
I had a buddy that I joined a service with, and we stayed friends throughout the time. I still have contact with him, and he was our best man at our wedding, and we celebrated our 50th 3 years ago, and he was there.
Nice.
Well, as I said, I only spent 21 months in the Air Force because I got diabetes just after basic training and after I had my medic training. So I was spent most of my Air Force career trying to stay in while they were trying to discharge me. But I have to say the word Facebook, because now I am friends with a woman who I was in basic training with, and her name is Betty Shipp. And I'm going to investigate tonight if she's related to Jean or not, so I think that's a fascinating connection. So Betty and I are still friends. But I really only had a couple people that I kept in touch with, and one was a colonel and her husband who kind of took me and a friend of mine in as their daughters, because we were, you know, 20, 19 years old, and that is your family. And we ended up being this couple's adopted daughter. And I kept track of her and her husband for several years with holiday cards, et cetera. Haven't so much anymore. I kind of lost track of them. But Betty and I are still like this on Facebook. But I didn't have a lot of connections because I didn't spend a whole lot of time to make those connections while I was in. So it's a very small part of my past, unfortunately.
Facebook. No, I think the camaraderie that's built in the military is one of a kind. I really, my transition out has been amazing. I've been very fortunate. I work in a community where I'm met daily with veterans, but in the military, the friendships that are built, especially when you're in combat, are just one of a kind. And unfortunately, I've had to lose a few friends from combat. And so those friends were no longer in touch, obviously, but we try to stay in touch with the families.
So, yeah, you know, some of the relationships that I have today are 35-year relationships because I met them when I began service. And I just continue to keep in touch with them. Friends on Facebook, call them. Those are some of the most lasting relationships that I have in my life, besides my family. And you're right. You build those kind of relationships while you're serving. But Gene's also right, because I'm friends with you for 3 years, and now I'm moving away. That's an unfortunate nature of the military. We have an advantage at our age that Gene never had. He couldn't track them on Facebook. But they are important relationships, and they build us, and they hold us up.
See, my kids were born on military base, my son and my daughter. They had never been off military bases. They went to visit my parents. And when they finished high school and came here to IU, they said, "What, well, Jack? What's?" I said, "You in the real world now." But they'd learned to adjust just like I did, because they was traveling with their dad. They'd never been off the base, just to visit my parents, until they came here. And it was a shock. And I said, make your adjustment. You already broke into it in the military. You're used to making friends, so and they made it.
We're going to do a couple more questions here, and then I'm going to open up the floor. If there are veterans or spouses of veterans who have interesting stories to tell, I think that we would love to hear them. And then if there's anything that the panelists can think of that they would like to highlight about their careers, we'd like you to offer that as well. I think, Jean, I think you mentioned the difference in health care between VA hospitals and regular care facilities, or maybe it was you, Susan. Was it you? Do you any ideas on how that is and maybe why that is?
What I'm finding is with my health care in the VA that it's more cookie cutter, that everybody gets the same type of thing. Like I have type 1 diabetes, so I get a meter and I get strips to test my blood sugar with. Well, out in public health care, I had my choice of what kind of meter I wanted. If I wanted one that had lots of data, things that I could enter into it and was a little bit like a computer almost, versus in the VA, everybody gets the same standard, like boots. You know, everybody gets the same boots and basic training. Everybody gets the same meter. Everybody gets the same type of strips that go in the meter and the same amount of strips. So it doesn't matter. Like, I test 7 times a day, and some people only have to test 2 or 3 times a day, so I need more strips. Well, I only get as much as everybody else does. And so it's just those kind of things. And like eyeglasses, I went to get my eyes examined the other day, and I had to get a new prescription. Well, I walked into the place to get the prescription. There was like a wall with 2 panels, men's and women's, and there was probably 50 pairs of frames on each one versus you go to a place now and there's like 250 things to choose from. And I thought it was a lot easier because I didn't have to make so many choices. It was like that one, and I was done. So it's just that kind of thing. Not that the expertise is still there. It's just the matter of being kind of the same prescription down the line.
Mm-hmm. Did your military experience influence your thinking about war and about the military in general? Or are you still dyed-in-the-wool patriots?
Thinking about it relative to your time before you were in the military, your kind of thoughts about the military and what it was like and what war or something like that would mean versus kind of your experience now on the backside of it. You know, did anything change during that time? Or do you still kind of view it the same way?
Well, when I went in, Vietnam was just finishing up. And I was not really old enough during Vietnam to pay a lot of attention to it. I didn't have anybody in the war. I didn't really have a connection to it, so it didn't impact my life a lot. So when I got in under peacetime, you know, I really didn't feel like I was in the military. I felt like I was at a technical school. Because I, you know, wasn't around people dying. I wasn't shooting. I wasn't really in a war situation. So war was very far removed from my experience in the military. And since coming out, I don't know that I would do that again. I mean, I don't know if I was 19 now, if I would make the same decision to go into the military, because I am very much against war, and not our soldiers or not what they're doing, but the fact that we have to be there disturbs me a lot. So, I could be a peacenik, but I would rather see us be a peaceful world and not have to go through what everybody's having to go through right now. So I'm in a very different place.
I would say for me, I always looked up to my grandparents. Both my grandfathers were in World War II, and they couldn't even speak about it. I mean, it was just what they experienced was so heavy. And I'm just honored to be a part of a panel that has such a history just within the state of Indiana. I'm so humbled. I these are my superstars, right? Like these are the guys that I want autographs from. I don't want to go to LeBron James and get an autograph from him. He doesn't do anything. Right? He didn't do anything important. These guys did. Our veterans that are sitting in this crowd right now did. They did something, and it was meaningful. And that was my desire when I joined. And then 9/11 was very fresh. I mean, 9/11 was the epitome of why I joined. It was the final answer as to, this is what I'm going to do. And I got exactly what I asked for. I got war. I grew up in combat. I didn't grow up with peacetime. And I think that changed a lot of my perspective on life in general. Would I do it again? I'd have to say absolutely. I do not regret any of my days. I miss my brothers so much. But without the sacrifice of those types of guys, I don't know what I'd be. I'd probably be a waste of space just sitting in Bloomington without a job. I don't know what I'd be doing without the military.
I still have Mary yelling at me occasionally.
I was doing it just after the break.
Yeah. But I basically grew up in the service. I went directly from high school to the service, and I'm thankful for the experience and the guidance that I got along the way.
Well, there are no good wars, but they're wars for good purposes, and I'm still for a very strong military.
What about everything good seemed like come when the war ended? And the United States will never be the same since World War II ended. That was the biggest change in the United States. And I'm a military man, I guess. Old soldiers never die. They just fade away.
One of the piece of my experience that kind of fits with this, my dad is a Vietnam vet, and he was what they call a draft-induced Marine. The Army sent him a notice that they were going to draft him, so he went and joined the Marine Corps. My dad's side of the family is all Navy Marine Corps, so he wasn't going to let the Army have him, was kind of his motto. And he, coming out of Vietnam, he had some real, when I decided I was going to join the military, he had some real troubling thoughts about what that meant and why and what my experience would be and a lot of that. And I had the opportunity for him to participate. And Marine Corps has a thing called a Tiger Cruise, which is when you're coming back on deployment on ship, you can have a male member of your family come out and meet you in Hawaii, and then they can ride back on the ship from Hawaii to California with you. So they spend like 5 days on ship. And my dad had the opportunity to do that. And besides giving him a chance to kind of reconcile some of his military experience and that, he told me afterwards, he said, I see now, military is a lot different than when I was in. And I can see what it's done for you. I can see how it's kind of put you on track. I wasn't exactly a real rock star student or just person in general. And so, you know, that for him was an experience. Seeing me and seeing the how different the military service was became a big piece of that. He also thought it was interesting because it was his first time never riding a helicopter with nobody shooting at him. You know, it was a lot of these sort of things that kind of changed his experience about the military, things he always thought of as being negative, he saw as being positives. And I see that with a lot of my students on campus. You know, their families sometimes had a lot of apprehension about their service, or some of them were very excited about their service. And then the experiences that student had while they were in the service kind of comes to shape what that is and what it looks like afterwards. So people's attitudes change about their service quite a bit. And even their own attitudes will change over time. So it's interesting to see that piece of it.
Well, and we can see the changes in the military from the time when Bob started serving, or Gene started serving, women in the military. Well, they were WACs, or they were WAVES, or they were WAIFs. They wore dresses, and unless really you were a nurse, you didn't go very far in the military. Then fast forward to Susan. Couldn't get on board a Navy ship. So she joined the Air Force. Viable. Go a little further forward to when I joined the military. A combat field was not something that was open to me. I joined the military police because that was as close to it as I could come. And now today you see women serving in combat roles, going through schools that were always closed to them before. So it's a huge difference across the generations, and I think that that's what this little panel this evening has brought to light, is the different experiences. And yet, while they're different, there's a lot that's still the same. So from the panel members, is there anything you'd like to add that we didn't discuss this evening?
One very obvious thing that changed during time I was in was we went from a drafted army,
yeah,
good people, to an all-volunteer army, good people. But it's quite different.
You have been listening to Generation Speak on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Just finished listening to the panelists at the second annual Generation Speak event talk about their experiences as a veteran and during their time in the military. Panelists range from age 35 to 95 and included veterans Gene Shipp, Bill Porteous, Bob Price, Chris Snell, and Susan Sebastik. Mary Elfman and John Summerlott moderated the panel. We now return to the panel discussion.
Do is we're going to invite you as audience members, and ladies, I know you may not have served, but if your husband served and you stood beside him during that time, your service still counts. So if you have stories you would like to share, we got about another 20 minutes or so.
I'm a retired teacher, and I would like to know what value education had early on in the military as compared to now. Do they still want you to have a good education? Did they want you to have one when a lot of you started out?
Well, I would venture to say because of when I joined, we were heavy into invading Iraq. I think all the teachers that I ran into in my school time, they pushed for education, obviously. And then throughout the military, there was a push at the beginning a little bit, but it wasn't as much. They were more focused on doing our thing overseas. But towards the end of it, there was a huge push of making sure you use the GI Bill, go get college. Like, they knew something was coming, but me at 26 was like, whatever, dude, I'll get up and do my thing, which made my transition a little rough. So that there's a big push right now, I can tell you that. Our military is transitioning from the wartime aspect to the more getting into the peacetime. And so promotions rely on education. Promotions rely on leadership courses. So in order to get your stripes, in order to get and continue going up in rank, leadership schools, education, it is all part of that, and it's called professional military education, and they require it.
You know, when I was in it as a medic, they were encouraging all of us who were medics to enroll in nursing school while we were still in the military. And it was difficult to do that, to work full-time and try to get a nursing career. But they certainly made it very easy for me to step out of the service and into nursing school with my veteran benefits, by paying for my tuition, my books, giving me money to live on, so I didn't have to work during my education. And at the time I was getting my nursing degree, I started out with an associate degree, and I was doing the research, and it said, you know, we want nurses these days to have a bachelor's degree, and we think that's the stepping stone to start nursing, should be a bachelor's degree. So I went and talked to my VA representative and said, you know, would you be interested in paying for 2 more years? Because I really think that's where we're going, and I think I really need to have a bachelor's degree. And they agreed, and I got 2 more years and a bachelor's degree out of my VA education. So, I mean, that was the best thing that happened to me, to get diabetes and get out, because I got to go to college and was ready to go to college at that point, and had a really successful nursing career after the fact.
Well, one thing I'll add to that is one of the legacies of the GI Bill after World War II is that education and the military got linked, that they got connected in ways that they aren't in any other country. If you do comparative studies and you look at other countries, there's no other country that has something like the GI Bill, that kind of the military and education are tied together in that way. And so, you know, from my experience in the 90s on, everywhere you go, there's a push for education. There's classes, colleges come and teach classes on base. We were actually deployed on ship, and Central Texas College sent a faculty member out to teach college algebra on ship while we were deployed. I went through Iraq and Kuwait carrying a college algebra textbook in my pack with the rest of my stuff. But part of it was because I knew I wanted to get ahead. I knew you had to have these education pieces in order to do that. And that's what I see on our student vets today that are coming in. Many of them already have 30, 45 college credit hours coming in that they've picked up either through schools or through training with the military.
One of the things that was so poignant to me was when I joined the military, I served beside men, high-ranking men, enlisted ranks, who could write enough to sign their names so they could sign their paychecks. And that was the standard. And over the years, it has gotten to, you can't graduate from high school, join the Army. And now it is, I'm sorry, if you didn't graduate from high school, the Army can't use you. They have gone to more of a thinking service, all five of the services. They want you to come in. You can't come in without at least that high school diploma. Now, during the Second World War and during Korea, many young men left high school to join the military for patriotism reasons. Many of them lied about how old they were because still, you know, 17 with a parental signature, but I have met men who joined the military at age 16. They grew up in the military, and they got their diplomas from the military. But yes, it has gone to more of a thinking military as opposed to just someone who can point and shoot.
And with all the modern technology we have now, education is a must. You have to be retrained to be a mechanic, to work on a vehicle, because without knowledge of computers and all this modern technology, I wouldn't know how to work on a vehicle now myself. You open the hood of a vehicle, it's all covered up. Can't see that much dipstick for the transmission and oil. You got to be trained. You go up on that, take that cover off. You got to know what you're doing when you go up under there to work. But education is a must in military, and in fact, everywhere.
Yeah, I was in the Navy. I was a draftee. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was a draftee in the Navy. Believe it or not, there were some, because the Defense Department was short of enlistments. And a couple reflections I have. One is that, and I had 2 boot camps, not because I failed, but because I got sick and I had to go back. In both of those boot camps, we have to remember that there was a cadre of people in boot camp, mostly men, of course, who were quite educated and quite well-trained because they didn't want to serve more than 2 years, and therefore they were willing to go through the draft. And when I was a hospital corpsman in the Navy, when there were 2 pharmacists that were people who had degrees in pharmacy, for example, that were going through hospital core school because they only wanted to serve the 2 years. So what I wanted to point out, A, is that there was a reasonably qualified cross-section of people when there was a draft, very much so. And some had 2 or 3 years of engineering or some other thing like that who were enlisted people, but they decided they didn't want to serve more than two years. The other thing is I went in 8 months after, too late for the GI Bill. But I have to tell you, I had my own GI Bill because I was a hematology technician, and I won't tell you about all the battles I fought in a children's clinic in Naval Operating Base in Norfolk. But I had my own GI Bill because I went to school after college, I mean after the military, in a small college. And I applied for a job at this 30-bed hospital, and they put me on as a evening hematology technician where I got my food and I was able to study there. So in a sense, I had the same thing as a GI Bill, even though I went in too late. What I'm trying to point out is that I learned a skill that I was able to use to get me through school.
One of the things we're doing right now at universities across the country is trying to find people who have those skills in the military and then find our programs on campus that match up with that so we can go out there and recruit them and say, when you get out, come look at us.
I think that we're at our hour, and I so appreciate everybody coming out because, you know, I know that the military service for you was probably the most important thing that's ever going to happen in your life, or at least not maybe the most, but it's going to rank up there as having a huge impact. And I don't think that I personally don't feel like we do our veterans justice on Veterans Day, because I think the stories need to be told, and I think people need to talk about it, and I think there's healing that comes when we talk about it. So I appreciate everybody who has come out and have lent your ear to these veterans, and for those in the audience who are veterans that didn't get to tell your story or didn't get to answer your question, I'm sorry, but hopefully we'll have this kind of thing again, and the stories can continue.
You just finished listening to a panel discussion entitled Generation Speak that took place on November 11th at the Beltrace Senior Living Community. This panel was about how wartime has changed over multiple generations, and it housed veterans aged 35 to 95. Panelists discussed how communication from war zones has changed, along with how the expectation of education after leaving the service has changed. Panelists included veterans Gene Shipp, Bill Porteous, Bob Price, Chris Snell, and Susan Savastik. Mary Elfman and John Summerla moderated the panel.
The audio for today's episode is courtesy of Community Access Television Services.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered News and Public Affairs Department here on Community Radio, WFHB.